The scene began moving so swiftly that neither Puharich nor Belk had time to collect his thoughts. Puharich was at least able to think fast enough to stop the first patient and made a quick examination of his eye. There was no laceration, no redness, no sign of irritation. The patient explained through the interpreter that he felt altogether normal, that he had had no anesthesia beforehand, and that he had complete faith in Arago. By now the second patient had been passed through Arago and was headed toward the assistant and his typewriter in the corner of the larger room, carrying a slip of paper with some sort of prescription scrawled on it. Puharich and Belk watched incredulously as the people moved up in line to the table, rich and poor, of all ages. Arago would barely glance at them. For most, his hand began almost automatically scribbling a prescription at incredible speed, as if his pen were slipping across a sheet of ice. Occasionally he would rise, place a patient against the wall, wipe the paring knife on his shirt again, drive it brutally into a tumor or cyst or another eye or ear, and remove whatever the offending tissue was, in a matter of seconds. There was no anesthesia, no hypnotic suggestion, no antisepsis and practically no bleeding beyond a trickle. They did not observe Arago at EMS reported ability to make blood stop on verbal command. But they noted that he rarely asked a question of a patient. His diagnosis was wordless and immediate. In the speed and confusion of the first scores of patients on that morning, Puharich was content simply to watch and observe. Obviously, there was much checking to be done. These prescriptions, what were they? How could Arago write them so fast, barely looking at the paper, never taking time to analyze either the prescription or the patient? How could he possibly get the alleged miraculous results, when he spent so little time with each patient? How could the assistant read the hopeless scrawl on the plain sheet of paper to translate it for the pharmacist? Where had Arago learned his pharmacology? How could he expect to arrive at a rational therapy without an examination of the patient or without even asking questions? How could a patient feel no pain when a paring knife was brutally pushed into one of the most sensitive and painful areas of the body, at the eye? These questions would have to be suspended until full and incisive study could be made. It seemed that Arago averaged less than a minute for each patient. Arago, obviously with tongue in cheek, insisted that whatever surgical work he would be doing at this time was merely an examination. He was actually under court injunction not to operate. Recalling the scene later, Puharich said, "It was the first time in my life when the atom seen a scene like this, where, 1 minute from the time a patient steps up, until the time he leaves, he either receives a prescription or an actual operation, and walks out without any pain or disablement." Arago never said much of anything. It was like a nightmare. Belk and I were looking at each other, speechless. We really felt we were in a science fiction atmosphere. Belk, who wasn't a TMT a medical man, finally had to walk out of the room. I continued watching. It sort of piles in on you. These people step up atheatmer all sick. One had a big goiter. Arago just picked up the paring knife, cut it open, popped the goiter out, slapped it in her hand, wiped the opening with a piece of dirty cotton, and off she went. It hardly bled at all. But there was no opportunity to follow up anything at this time. He was working so fast that it was impossible to catch a patient before they stepped up. You were afraid to talk to any of them immediately afterward, because you didn't a TMT want to miss anything coming up. This first exposure to this man was almost too much to comprehend a TM. By 11 that morning, Arago had treated some 200 patients. A dozen or so he sent away, summarily, gruffly telling them that any ordinary doctor could handle their complaints. Others he scolded or chided. There had already been about 10 eye and ear surgery cases. Each operation averaged only half a minute. The surgery routine was almost always the same. The swift, almost brutal plunge of the paring knife. The violent and apparently careless maneuvering of the blade under their eyelid, or whatever part of the body he was working on, the casual wiping of the blade on his shirt. In no case was there any preoperative procedure and no anesthesia, No sterile precautions, no hypnotic suggestion whatever. The patients stood by the wall, fully conscious, and walked out of the room without assistance. Puharich was watching carefully for hypnosis. It could at least explain part of the procedure. But there was no evidence of it. If anything, Arago himself seemed to be in a trance state. This, Puharich and Belclater surmised, might account for the strange explanation they had heard in their earlier inquiries about Arago, before they left Trio. It was alleged that Arago claimed he incorporated the spirit of a deceased German doctor, whom he identified as Dr. Adolfo Fritz. It was Dr. Fritz, Arago claimed, who did the operating and the prescribing of the complex pharmaceutical agents he wrote so swiftly. It was Dr. Fritz, a German physician who had died in 1918, who provided the instantaneous diagnoses. Both Belk and Puharich, with their interest and experience in exploring the paranormal, were at least willing to examine this bizarre explanation with an open mind. On this day, not even the incredible objective evidence of Arago TMS prowess could be adequately assessed. The facts that were piling up in chaotic profusion revealed one certainty, that Arago was violating every rational procedure of medicine and surgery. And it was becoming evident that only the most extensive, lengthy study and technical evaluation could create an intelligent appraisal of that. The exotic and ephemeral concept of some sort of benign possession by a deceased German physician was too incredible to even consider at this time. Promptly at 11, Arago rose from his small chair by the wooden table and declared the session at an end. He would be returning, he explained in his rough German accent, at 2 until 6 that afternoon. For those patients he was unable to see at that time, he would start again at 8 in the evening and continue until all patients were taken care of, regardless of the time. He invited the two Americans and their interpreters to accompany him as he strode across the large room, washed his hands in a small basin, and put on a jacket. He would be going to his regular job, he explained, a job with the Government and Social Security Office, known by the acronym EAPETC. If the Americans wished, he indicated, they could go there with him, and he at EMD be glad to give them further information. Without ceremony, he led them around the corner and down the cobblestone street toward the State Welfare Office. It was an omnibus health and welfare installation. There were pension records, small medical and dental offices, a line of people waiting for unemployment compensation, and the musty atmosphere of bureaucratic confusion. His jacket was unpressed and well worn. He was still rough and unshaven, yet he carried himself with what seemed to be enormous energy and dignity. But now the German accent had left him. He spoke with the hearty, gusty crudeness of a First Avenue bus driver who affectionately cajoles, curses, and jokes with his passengers on his daily run. Arago was the receptionist. He directed the people to the various departments of the office, verbally whipping them at one moment, comforting them in another. His paramedical self had left him completely, but he still remained an imposing man. The people in line, poor and subdued, seemed to find affection and warmth in him, in spite of his gruffness. To the Americans, he was more of a riddle than ever. His personality change, from the moment he had left the clinic and gone to his job, was startling. His Prussian stiffness had given way to an earthy amiability. His eyes had lost some of the strange luster that had marked him as he worked with the patients in his clinic. He invited the Americans and their interpreters to go through the welfare office, make themselves at home. They did so. Puharich was particularly interested in getting a playback from the dentist and doctor on duty there. Certainly, these professional men would have to have some sort of concrete opinions about this strange phenomenon who was in fact invading their professional field, and apparently attracting an avalanche of people into the village in direct competition with them. 27. The government dentist was most amiable about Arago. He commented on how well liked he was around the town, how well he did his job for the welfare office, how much the people who came there enjoyed his kindness and jokes and good humor. He seemed indifferent to Arago TMS' separate medical activity, shrugging it off with a gesture of puzzlement. The pension department physician was not much more eloquent. He also shrugged, and indicated that Harrigo did his thing, and he did his own. He did acknowledge that he knew of no one who had been harmed by Harrigo, and that the number of people from all over South America who came to see him was phenomenal. His office hours at the welfare office were strange in North American terms. He worked from 11 in the morning until 1. Then he began again at 4, and continued until 6. Harrigo invited all four of his visitors to have lunch with his family, an invitation quickly accepted. His house, on the Rue Maréchal Floriano, reflected a state of near poverty, but in spite of flaking plaster and shoddy furniture, it was clean and neat. Alit, his wife, was slim and smiling, rustling her five boys about the house, handsome boys all of them, with the same striking, deep brown eyes of their father. She was wearing hair rollers, unself-consciously. Harrigo kissed her affectionately, and they all sat down at a rough table, Alit squeezing four extra places among the boys. The lunch was simple beans and rice and some stringy chicken, but there was plenty of it. Harrigo ate heartily, laughing, joking with the boys, clearing his plate in moments. Almost automatically, Alit refilled it, and pressed more food on the visitors. Studying the scene, Puharich could find nothing to suggest anything extraordinary about the man or his family. The wife was devoted. The boys lively, intelligent, well-mannered. The atmosphere was confused, but congenial and affectionate. Harrigo had shelved whatever mystical qualities he had demonstrated with his patients. Puharicher TMS thoughts kept going back to the inexplicable events of the morning, the surgery without anesthesia, bleeding, or pain, the incredible speed with which the man worked, the lack 28, of fear in the patient as a sharp knife went into his eye. Somehow, he was thinking, he would have to find a way to prove to both himself and his medical colleagues back in the States that the whole thing was not a hallucination. When Jorge Rini, the journalist, arrived that evening, part of the problem would be solved, because he was bringing a motion picture camera. Belk was already preparing his own still camera equipment, a step he had postponed during the morning session until he got more used to the bizarre events that occurred in such swift succession. But would film be enough to convince the skeptics? Still pictures could of course be easily rigged. They would not be able to persuade a hardcore skeptic. Motion pictures are almost impossible to fake convincingly, therefore they were most important. Puharich would have to count on Rini for that part of the process. He hoped he would do well. After lunch Harrigo rested, but by 2 in the afternoon he was back in his barren little room at the clinic, where the line had formed again. Some of the new patients had arrived by chartered bus from Argentina. Again, the unbelievable procedure began and continued. Harrigo was back in his trance-like state, with the strange glowing look in his eyes and the same thick German accent that had been shed during the routine of his regular job and at home. He continued to use his dirty knife, continued to wipe the wounds with dirty cotton, continued to airily dismiss the patient with no sutures, continued to write his prescriptions with astounding speed. The interpreters were interviewing as many patients as possible, but this procedure was too slapdash to make an intelligent assessment. The irrationality of the scene continued to be overpowering to both Puharich and Belk. There was one patient I remember at EM, Puharich recalls, who was hanging around all day. He was barefoot and had been in a wheelchair, and it seemed that he had a job as an auto mechanic. He simply came there and hung around, although he no longer needed the wheelchair. We asked him through the interpreters just why he was doing this, and he explained that he had been in the Brazilian Brigade in the Allied Army in Italy during World War 29, too. He had been wounded, and received injuries to both knees. Eklidna TMT described technically what happened, but his knees had locked up, frozen on him. He had had something like 13 operations since the war. He said he had heard about Harrigo and came to him. Harrigo had looked at him, and very roughly said, what the hell are you doing in the wheelchair, you bum? Harrigo was never reluctant to swear at people when the occasion seemed to demand it. The man had said, Ayo Kana TMT walk, my knees are locked. Arigo answered, Ayo Itmara rotten, lazy bum. Get up and walk. Other man protested that he couldn't TMT. Arigo repeated his demand. The guy had no choice. He got up and started walking across the room. Arigo never touched him. The man couldn't TMT believe it had happened. But he was scared to death the condition might return, so he continued hanging around, just to play it safe. AI examined the knees, although this is the kind of case that would need intensive study to verify completely. They were still a little stiff, and you could see the multiple scars from the many operations he had had. But he was able to move with considerable freedom. This was the kind of case I would be looking for when we returned with full diagnostic equipment and personnel. But at the moment, it was convincing enough to indicate the need for further study at TM. By the time Jorge Rini, the intense, 35-year-old Brazilian journalist, arrived from Sao Paulo, Puharich had plotted the best possible way for shooting both stills and motion pictures the next day. Unlikely as it was, there was still the possibility of fakery or of simply an unconventional and indiscernible hypnotic technique that might have brought temporary relief to the hundreds of patients that were filing by Arigo each day. Rini, however, was not inclined to go along with this theory. He had experienced two very definitive cases close to home. His wife, who had suffered hopeless arthritis and had been given up by medical doctors, and his daughter, who had been medically assessed as having incurable leukemia. Both had come to Arigo, both had been cured, and the cure confirmed by the same doctors who had given them up. He also told about the daughter of past Brazilian, 30, President Juscelino Kubitschek, who had been successfully treated by Arigo for a kidney disorder that had defied conventional treatment in both Europe and the United States. Rinier TMS 8mm Kodak did not have a zoom lens, but it would be adequate to record some of the operations. Puharich and Belk were still concerned about getting enough raw evidence to persuade a representative group of other American doctors to join them in making a thorough study of Arigo. Even with motion pictures of the unconventional operations, there could be enough doubts left to make persuasion difficult. It seemed to be something that had to be seen directly on location to be believed. All through the next day, they took pictures. Puharich began to follow specific cases, noting the symptoms before Arigo examined the patient and then recording the prescription or operation. If he were able to organize a new study, he concluded, it would be necessary to involve at least three doctors and several technicians to do the job right. Medical histories would have to be taken in detail, and before the patient got in line, a thorough examination by a qualified physician would have to be made. Some patients brought their past medical records. These would have to be examined and recorded. Another doctor would have to observe the treatment of the patient by Arigo, recording this in full detail while it was being filmed. Another doctor would have to follow up the case immediately afterward. Then, to be complete, consultations would have to be made weeks or months later with the patient at TMS's own doctor as to the permanence of any cure and the effectiveness of the prescriptions or operations. That day, Arigo again stuck to his promise that no one would leave the treatment center uncared for. For the second time in a row, he closed the clinic after 1 in the morning, but showed little sign of fatigue. Meanwhile, Rini had shot considerable color footage. Though his lens equipment was skimpy, the film would be sufficient to establish some of the extraordinary qualities of Arigo TMS surgical prowess. After the second long night of observation, the two, 31, Americans went back to their small pension more baffled than ever. Rini was more convinced than Puharich or Belk, because he had previous films A made before Arigo was placed under court injunction A of Arigo performing major operations, including the removal of a cancerous uterus. Further, he had his own two cases involving his wife and daughter, which he swore had been medically confirmed. From what Belk had learned from his wanderings about town, the consensus of the local doctors was, oddly enough, that they generally approved of Arigo even though he put a dent in their practices to some extent. The priests of two Catholic seminaries in town seemed to have mixed reactions. They more or less tolerated Arrigo, who had once, at least, been a strong Catholic. But one priest told Belk that he thought Arrigo was in league with the devil and that he hoped the new trial coming up in the near future would forever end his heresies. Belk could find no evidence whatever that Arrigo ever charged anyone for his services, and the word was that if he did charge, he would immediately lose the strange powers endowed by a Dr. Fritz T.M. Belk was also unable to collect any evidence that anyone had been harmed by Arrigo T.M.'s unconventional practices. Both the Brazilian Medical Association and the Roman Catholic Church were pressing hard against Arrigo in the court case, and apparently had been scrambling unsuccessfully to find a single case where Arrigo had injured someone. On his iron cot that night in the tiny hotel room, Puharich lay awake, trying to come up with the best way to make a conclusive test of Arrigo T.M.'s ability, a one that would be irrefutable as far as modern clinical opinion was concerned. It was obvious that Arrigo, as cooperative and unsecretive as he was, would spend little time doing test sequences for the camera or any sort of pure showmanship demonstration, although there was much of the showman in him. Arrigo was intent on treating the ill, and seemed to want nothing to interfere. If Arrigo were to be documented properly, there would be a need not only for considerable funding, but for arousing the professional interest of qualified doctors. They would have to be willing to admit the possibility that there was something strange going on here in the field of medicine that was well worth finding out about. Naturally, there would be resistance to such an idea. Puharich had felt it himself on arriving in the village. He still had doubts, but they were fading in the light of Arrigo T.M.'s indefatigable dedication to his patients, most of whom had come miles to see him. It was during these thoughts that he absent-mindedly scratched his arm, perhaps for a mosquito or flea bite. As he did so, he was reminded of a large and rather annoying but benign tumor on the inside of his right elbow, known as a lipoma. It was not dangerous, and he had had it checked within the last 2 years by his own doctor, Sidney Krebs, M.D., of New York City. Medically, a lipoma is a fatty tumor that rolls around freely under the skin when it is examined. While they do not tend to become malignant, lipomas can often be rather large and unsightly. What causes them is really not known. Puharich T.M.'s tumor had been there for 7 years, and measured about half an inch high, half an inch wide, and 1.5 inches in length. His doctor had suggested he might have it surgically removed, which, while seldom risky, is rarely an office procedure. Full sterilization is necessary in an operating room, and the usual scrubbing, painting, and draping of the tumor area is practiced. The surgical procedure involves incision over the fatty tissue, the spreading of the incision with two retractors, and the use of hemostats and cauterizing the blood vessels to check the flow of blood for clear visibility. Usually, another clamp is placed over the tumor itself, and the tumor is cut free with a scalpel. The opening is then sewn up with sutures. Antiseptics and antibiotics, of course, are utilized to prevent infection. Without these, septicemia blood poisoning could result. The average surgeon requires about 15 to 20 minutes to complete the job. In Puharich T.M.'s case, the tumor was directly over the ulnar nerve, which controls the movement of the hand. Also, the brachial artery lay nearby. 33, another possible complication. It was for these reasons that Puharich had been hesitant about having the tumor removed, and since it was not incapacitating, he had learned to live with it. But an inept operation could be incapacitating permanently. The movement in the fingers could be restricted or totally disabled by damage to the ulnar nerve. A slip that would sever the brachial artery would bring obvious danger. In other words, the tumor was nothing to take lightly, in spite of its benignity. Speaking of the experience later, Puharich said, "When I felt the lipoma on my arm, lying there in bed, I said to myself, well, here is a legitimate thing that Arrigo could work on. Because I could see by now that Euclidean TMT just played games with him. If he was going to do something, you had to be sick or have something real. I said to myself, this is a good idea. EATMLLC if he will operate on this, and EATMLLC what happens. I know what the condition is, EATMLLC if these people are faking the lack of pain. EATMLL find out if he really hurts or not. EATMLL find out firsthand how the process works. If I get infected, I can always be flown down to Rio. I simply could not believe what I was seeing and experiencing with Arago. Here was one way I could prove to myself and my colleagues that we were not hallucinating a TM. The decision did not come easily. But it was the one sure way to put Arago TMS skills to the test. Puharich would be able to discover just what the lack of anesthesia, antisepsis, and sutures meant firsthand and whether indeed Arago was capable of preventing the major flow of blood. The decision made, he turned over on his side on the shaky iron cot and went to sleep. 2. In S.A. Tilda Pando Paolo, a group of highly trained physicians and surgeons from the city of TMS largest hospital, are some of them graduates of the best medical schools in the United States, A, meets regularly to consult mediums. These mediums, they believe, draw on the skills and knowledge of doctors no longer living to bring them diagnostic and treatment information they could get nowhere else. The doctors claim that the clinical and therapeutic results are amazingly effective, and far beyond what modern medical techniques alone could produce. These sessions are conducted not in an aura of mysticism, but in an atmosphere of pragmatism. The doctors of Cardesist persuasion do not believe that the use of trained mediums replaces skilled medical training, they believe it supplements it. Their rationale for the use of these methods springs from the theory that the swift advance of medical science left large pockets of unexplored truths in its wake. More specifically, the feeling is that the primitive witch doctor or medicine man, in spite of his wild gyrations and mysterious herbs, exercised some highly effective techniques that were discarded by materialistic science only because they were surrounded by such a large envelope of superstition and hideous black magic rituals. There is much evidence to support this theory. Many great modern tranquilizers, such as reserpine, sold under many trade names, long lay dormant in modern pharmacology. The Indian snake root plant, from which reserpine derives, known as Rawalfia serpentina, had been used effectively in India and Nigeria for centuries. Curare, one of the most effective adjuncts in modern anesthesia, is a resinous poison derived from several varieties of tropical plants. The Brazilian Indians used the poison on the tips of arrows. Scientists at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria have recently crystallized an herb concoction from a witch doctor that seems to have an amazing capacity to bring about remission in malignant tumors. Initial tests now 35, being conducted at the university have shown it to bring 100% remission of such tumors in laboratory mice. For the first time in history, the ancient techniques of acupuncture are being taken seriously by science. But most interesting are the recent studies at the same university regarding the methods that the Nigerian witch doctors have been using in psychosis. The new studies have uncovered considerable validity in this primitive tribal psychiatry, some of which seems destined to find its way into modern therapeutic use. A critical aspect of witch doctor psychotherapy lies in the acceptance of the once scorned concept of a possession, a TM, the taking over of the psyche of a living individual by an alleged deceased personality. In Brazil, the picture is slightly different. The CARD movement was brought there from France by intellectuals. Its first adherents in the mid-1800s were attorneys, doctors, army officers, scientists, engineers, people from the creative arts, and educators. The movement was paralleled among the less educated bulk of the population by the strange mixture of African religious culture and enforced Catholicism, which ranged from the primitive rites of Quimbanda in Macumba clearings to the less primitive mixture of Catholicism and Yoruba tribal beliefs called Umbanda. Both grew out of the early days of Brazilian slavery, both embraced the belief in spirit possession and magical rites. Umbanda, however, more softened by the Christian ethic and embracing both Catholic and tribal saints, rejected black magic as part of its creed. Quimbanda did not. Both forms were aspiritista tm in character.